Welcome back to another edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. You know, KP, I almost didn't have enough time to record this episode this week because I was so busy polishing my runner-up nomination on Basketball Fiends podcast competition. How does it feel to be just outside the top five podcasts about basketball in the universe? Pretty great.
You know, I think that's pretty solid. I mean, we've been doing this for what, like less than 6 months now, right?
Well, you've been carrying us since the beginning. I give you all the credit. I'm going to try to play the LaMarcus Aldridge role. Congratulations, Brandon, for an honor almost well-deserved. This is kind of like the Blazers last year, getting knocked out in the first round of the playoffs. Like, we weren't really there for the primetime competition, but we at least got some notoriety. So hopefully we both make it through this podcast without injury.
Yeah, I'm going to watch for my patella the entire time.
That's a serious deal. I mean, Prisbilla is in big trouble, isn't he?
I don't know if I'd say big trouble. I mean, you know, it's something that you can come back from, and I think he will, but his knee is never going to be the same. With Greg Oden's injury, I think we expressed a little optimism that these kind of injuries heal pretty predictably, even though it takes a very long time. And with Joel, it's certainly a more complex case because you've got the tendon involved, and then, you know, the mere fact that the kneecap dislocated is problematic and would sideline him for a long period of time, even if the tendon hadn't ruptured at the same time. So, you know, it's bad news. It's not good.
Were you impressed by Prisbilla's ability to issue the stretcher and just say, no stretcher, I'm going to let Tolliver carry me off? Tolliver, you know, probably has his best moment as a Blazer, helping Prisbilla off the court, literally the best moment he will ever have as a Blazer. And Pendergraf, you know, got to help carry Prisbilla off the court as sort of a prelude to his first minutes in the NBA. Didn't that say something about Prisbilla as a person, as a player, the kind of guy who's just going to say, I'm not going off on a stretcher regardless. I don't know how badly I'm hurt here. You know, in a worst-case scenario, this could be it. You know, he's getting up there in age anyways, so he wants to go off in a certain way. He's not gonna take the stretcher. He's not going to allow them to talk him into a stretcher. I thought that was kind of spoke to Joel's character a little bit.
I was kind of surprised that they let him walk off. I mean, obviously he was putting the weight on his right knee, so nothing that would have caused any damage. But I was still a little surprised when I first saw that photo.
I was surprised too, but then again, you got to think about it. You want to be the person to tell Prisbilla to get on a stretcher? You think he's going to listen to you? Especially if you're Jay Jensen and you're singing holiday songs probably at the airport waiting for the latest D-League call-up. I mean, nah, these guys don't have a chance, dude. Prisbilla's still got two working fists, you know? He's not going to let him take him off on a stretcher. It's not going down like that.
No. I mean, that's not Joel's style.
Joel's pretty gangster, and that's probably why I have his tattoo as a background on my Twitter, not in my house, the little man on his arm says. And unfortunately, Joel will not be in the house on Friday night when the Blazers play host to the Nuggets on Christmas. But, you know, more pressing than that is the game tonight against the San Antonio Spurs. What are the Blazers going to do here without Prisbilla, without Oden, without a true center, you know, even to play five? So right now they've got Juwan Howard, you know, who, as we've talked about ad nauseum on this podcast, this is pretty much the Juwan Howard haters podcast. But now that he's going to be the starting center, we've got a problem. So you've got Juwan Howard, who's too old. You've got LaMarcus Aldridge, who's too much of a four. And you want him to be a four because that's his position, and he's actually, you know, a pretty true four. And then you've got Jeff Pendergraf, who is kind of a combo 4-5, but, you know, he's played one game and he's coming back from hip surgery, and you really would like to limit his minutes if you can, given the, you know, the recovery process there. What do you do if you're the Blazers in the short term? I mean, they can't have a new player ready to play against the Spurs or probably even the Nuggets on Friday. How do you make this work? What kind of adjustments are we going to see, do you think, in the very short term?
Well, it'd be interesting to know what kind of limitations, if any, Jeff Pendergraf is under coming back from that hip surgery, like you mentioned. Because if he is healthy, I think you'd like to get him as many minutes as possible just to get him that experience, get those rookie jitters out of the way. I saw, given the circumstances And the fact that it was so unexpected, he did a really nice job against Dallas last night coming into the game, took a charge, got a couple of rebounds, you know, did what you need to do. Obviously, Juwan Howard, you know, is going to probably get the lion's share of those minutes, but my argument would be to probably go pretty heavy to small ball, which is not something Nate McMillan is unfamiliar with. You know, he definitely favored a lot of that during his time in Seattle before he had 2 7-footers like Joel Chrisville and Greg Oden. When you look at the Blazers, I broke it down the numbers by each center who was in the game, thanks to the good folks at basketballvalue.com and some fancy Excel work. So if you look at it, Greg Oden is obviously the team's best option at center. Well, they've outscored opponents by 8.8 points per 100 possessions, a net rating of 8.8 with him at the game. With Prisbill at center, they've been plus 3.3, so, you know, I think that matches what we've seen. Solid, but not as good as with Greg in there, obviously, a healthy Oden, especially a big drop-off at the offensive end of the floor, although, as we talked about earlier, they've actually been, again, defending better with Prisbill at center. But then when you look at everyone else, they've been outscored by 2 points per 100 possessions, but you can go further into that, and they're just getting killed with Howard. They're getting beat by 6.8 points per 100 possessions when Howard is playing center. That's assuming that when Aldridge and Howard are in the game, that Howard is the center in that lineup. So that includes those lineups. That's their worst offensive lineup out of the group, and it's also their worst defensive lineup. So it's not really giving you a lot. The sample size is way too small to look at anybody else, but there is a decent number of possessions with LaMarcus Aldridge playing center, and those lineups probably are even better than the ones with Oden at center. They've been beating teams by 9.9 points per 100 possessions and just going nuts at the offensive end. So the next layer of the analysis is this a fairly traditional lineup other than Aldridge at center? So basically you've got Aldridge and Dante Cunningham or Aldridge and Travis Outlaw. Those lineups have been solid, plus 5.8 points per 100 possessions. But the ones that are just killing it, and again, the sample is really small and it's specifically chosen periods, but when you have Aldridge and either Marchell Webster or Brandon Roy even at power forward, those lineups are scoring with an efficiency that's off the charts, 124.4 points per 100 possessions for an offensive rating. And even though they haven't been very good defensively, still their net is by far and away the best of any Blazers combination at plus 16.3 points per 100 possessions. So I know it sounds crazy, but I think you got to look at going super small, putting Markell even at the four to space the floor, put Aldridge at the five, maybe Cunningham at the four at times because you know that he's provided you some solid minutes off the bench, and going as much to the three-guard lineups as possible. They've been very successful this season, and there's just, you know, Juwan Howard is not bringing it right now. I mean, that's not what he was signed to do, was be the starting center. He was signed to provide his veteran leadership and things like that. And he's offered that, but on the court, he's not been very good at all.
Okay, so let's distinguish a little bit here, though. It's because when people think small ball, people think basically Don Nelson, you know? I mean, they think running down, loose, you know, don't really care about turnovers, you know, pushing tempo, just trying to get shots up as soon as possible in the shot clock. And what you're saying is the Blazers kind of have an alternate version of small ball that's worked pretty well for them, which has been Aldridge at five, and either, you know, four guards surrounding him or, you know, you get Cunningham maybe at the four and then you go three guards. Now, when they're going small like that, they're not necessarily pushing the pace, are they? They're still playing relatively slow. They're just scoring very efficiently because they've got so many weapons on the court. Is that kind of what the stats are leading you to?
Yeah, I'd have to look it up and do the calculations if you want to keep talking on the pace factor. But especially with, you know, simply with the three-guard lineups, which are already a version of small ball in themselves, even when you had them playing alongside Aldridge and Prisbilla, which was a more traditional front court, bigger front court even, you know, they weren't pushing the pace necessarily. We've seen those a lot in the fourth quarter the last couple weeks with Bayless and either Blake or Miller in there alongside Brandon Roy, and they've been thriving in the half court just because of the fact that getting the extra ball handler, that extra creator in there has helped open things up down the stretch.
You can really break guys off the dribble when you can get straight to the hoop. I mean, you can do a lot more one-on-one, and guys like Bayless, guys like Roy, and even guys like Miller, have an easier time getting to the basket when they don't have their own post guy there, and they don't really use the screens anyway, so it's not like they're losing a ton from Prisbilla on offense, except for obviously his offensive rebounding. You know, subjectively speaking, going back real quick to the whole pace thing, is I don't think when they've gone small like that, I don't think they've really pushed the pace at all. I think that, you know, maybe they're a little bit faster than they play when they have their standard lineup with a center in the game. But for the most part, this isn't what, you know, most people would expect when they first hear small ball. And I think that could become a good compromise for, you know, between the coaching staff who wants to limit turnovers, slow things down, and maybe some of the players who would like a little bit more freedom. I mean, this may be a way where we can finally see Andre Miller's skills of, you know, pushing the ball at the right time, getting to the basket, setting other people up. You know, hopefully some of the jump shooters will come on a little bit, you know, with Webster and Blake. This could be a good compromise here without having the center in, at least on the offensive end. I mean, they're going to have to score without rebounding because they're not going to have a ton of rebounding. So if it's not going to come from the shooting, they're going to be in some deep trouble, I would say.
Yeah, and I think that it doesn't have to necessarily be an out-and-out running gun fast break. It's just early offense. I think we saw a really good example of that. I believe it was last night where, you know, Roy was just running the court with his head up and spotted Aldridge with the only guy back was, I think, Jason Terry maybe for Dallas. And so Roy just threw it to the rim and Aldridge went up and got it, and there was nothing Jason Terry could possibly do about it. You know, it was just a heads up getting an early bucket when it was there, and that sort of thing can make a big difference.
It can make a huge difference because, I mean, those easy points just, you know, help your efficiency out so much. Part of the reason why the Blazers were so good on offense efficiency last year is that, you know, in transition, when they actually found themselves in transition, they scored at a really, I mean, solid efficiency rates. They were putting up easy layups. When they were blowing teams out at home, they were getting a lot of breakaway dunks. You know, Brandon was getting fouled a lot on the leak outs, which led to easy points. The Blazers just haven't had a ton of that this season, and you'd hope that, you know, maybe, you know, without Prisbilla, you know, obviously you have a big problem, which we talked about before we actually started the podcast, is that they're not going to get the defensive rebounding from Prisbilla and Odin that they've been used to, which can really help, you know, lead to fast breaks. But you'd hope that they push the tempo just slightly to get some of those easier baskets because they've got guys, you know, kind of across the board, their transition numbers are down. I mean, I was going back and looking at Martell Webster's numbers. You know, his career year when he was averaging 10 points a game in 2007, he was getting a fair bit of his offense in transition, and that team wasn't necessarily a running team back then either, but he was, you know, just getting out on the break, and obviously he can elevate and dunk and get layups, and he can make his free throws if necessary, and, you know, he's down. Obviously Andre Miller is not seeing the same transition numbers that he's seen previously in his career. Brandon's down in transition. So, you know, a major difference from last year to this year has been an even slower pace, but also, you know, less easy buckets in any sort of transition. They just haven't gone that route, and maybe they don't have a choice now.
Yeah, I mean, the one concern, as you said, is you got to get the defensive rebound first, and I think you're going to have to send more guys maybe to the defensive boards and have less of them leaking out because of the fact that you don't have a Prisbilla or an Odin there to kind of anchor you in the paint. So, you know, it's a matter of balancing that where one of the wings, you know, whether that be Webster or Roy, is the guy assigned to help with rebounding, and the other one is the one trying to get out and run.
Well, here's another question for you. How about more zone on defense? College look to things, and you just get, you know, you just pack the paint as much as you can, dare people to shoot over the top of you, try to close out hard and box out on shooters, and roll the dice. I mean, otherwise you're going to have tons of mismatches if you're playing, you know, three or four guards around Aldridge. And Aldridge is a mismatch, you know, against a lot of centers in this league.
Yeah, that's a way you can sort of protect guys and make up for the fact that you're so much smaller defensively. And, I really think that's one of Namath's strengths a lot of times is if you give him kind of flawed groups, he's willing to be creative to find a way to make it work, you know. I look back to some of the rosters and the lineups that he threw out there in Seattle, and you know, it's kind of amazing that he had as much success as he did with those teams. And I think that sometimes Nate tends to thrive in these situations even more than when he's given a lot of talent, like when the Blazers were healthy at the start of this season. Cast into sort of that underdog role, and he can start talking about scrappy. You know, we both know how much he loves throwing that term around. And I think that last night's win was a great example of that. You know, the Blazers had no business winning that game after losing Prisbilla. You know, they're shorthanded. playing a team that has been the second best in the Western Conference to this point on their home court, and to come out with a win, they're incredibly improbable in my mind.
You know, I can't. If I'm being completely honest with you, I was so busy updating Prisbilla's injury status that I didn't even watch the end of that game. I have to go back and watch it on tape at some point here, and it's not the first time that's happened this season. I think that's probably a pretty good indicator of how the season's shaken out. It's tough. So we've talked about all the things that we might see in the short term now for the Blazers. What can they do? What moves could they possibly make to, you know, fill out this roster? Whether, you know, it's most likely they'll be able to apply for a another hardship exception, because Prisbilla makes the fifth regular rotation player who's going to be missing extended time over the course of this season. So that would allow the Blazers to apply to the league for a hardship exception again. Obviously, you'd think they would want to fill this spot with a five because they have no fives. But, you know, as we talked about earlier this season, it's not like there's a ton of really talented fives available. You know, they turned one down in Jay Collins, who was here for training camp workouts. Not that he's a super talented five, but he was one of the best available. You know, a couple other names that are out there for D-leaguers. You know, there's Rod Benson. You know, would be an interesting – he could become a cult-like hero here in Portland, I think. And then you've got, obviously, Stephen Hill, who is already a hero and everywhere he goes, who was with the Blazers in the Summer League. Are those pretty much the two best candidates for available centers that wouldn't require a trade? Because I'm not getting the feeling that the Blazers really want to trade any of these parts that they've got. I mean, they like their roster when it's healthy. Now, obviously, that's a huge caveat. But, you know, looking forward long term, do they really want to sacrifice one of these pieces just to plug a hole in this season, which is kind of already shot to a certain degree? I'm not sure they do.
No, and I don't think that would be a good move. You know, it's about the long term, even though this year was supposed to be the start of – you know, aggressively competing in the Western Conference and trying to get deep into the playoffs. You know, those goals have changed, I think, given all the injuries. Right now, I think it's more about just getting into the postseason and, you know, trying to make some noise potentially there. But, you know, you don't want to sacrifice down the road and give up somebody who's going to be very promising. I mean, if you can swing a move where you're giving up a second-round pick or something like that, or, you know, then maybe you look into it. But I don't see anything obvious out there right now. So glancing at the blocks leaders in the D-League to kind of get an idea of the bigs that are out there, you know, you see a lot of guys who are not necessarily true centers but can fill in there, like Benson you mentioned. Cedric Simmons is a guy who's played in the league some, and there's a reason he's not in the league anymore. Dwayne Jones is a 6'11 guy out of St. Joe's, has had his moments in the NBA, you know, off the bench for Cleveland. A guy I like coming out of college. I think Devon Harden has been cut loose by the Oklahoma City Thunder, who drafted him in the second round in 2007. He's got pretty good size, you know, some decent skills. People probably remember him from playing at Cal. And then a guy that I really like, John Bryant out of Santa Clara, was in the draft this year. You know, he's a very different look from most of the guys you see in the D-League. He's probably 7 foot plus. You know, just an enormous guy, not very mobile, which is going to create some issues for him at the NBA level. But if you want somebody who's a really different look from everybody that you've got on the roster, he's someone who might fit that. Or Luke Neville, who played at Utah and is now with the Utah Flash, appropriately, in the D League.
Be honest with me, can any of these guys play?
You know, there's not anybody you're going to find probably that you're going to want in the rotation.
Ugh. Our entire audience just poured themselves another drink, KP.
The best answer is going to be give you, besides small balls, give you a chunk of those minutes to Pendergraf. And, you know, the Blazers obviously liked him when they went after him in the second round. You know, the first pick of the second round, or second pick, I should say, you know, a coveted pick, a spot where you get guys who can contribute. You know, we've seen Dante Cunningham give the team some good minutes so far, and I think Pendergraf can do something similar when he gets set and, you know, works out the kinks and starts understanding the NBA game. I mean, it's going to be a process. You especially hate for a rookie to miss training camp and preseason, because that's going to be one of his best chances to acclimate to the league. So he's kind of having to do that on the fly.
Well, you know, I remember back to Summer League, and he was fighting Joey Dorsey, which was pretty funny. Well, not fist fighting, but they were really going at it underneath both hoops on both ends. So he's obviously not going to back down from anyone. He's the kind of person, he's really tough, and he's, you know, it's not that he's not self-aware, but he just kind of doesn't really care what people think about him. So, I mean, if you throw him in against Tim Duncan, hey, he's not going to have the skills to guard Tim Duncan, but he's also not necessarily going to be afraid of Tim Duncan. You know, he's not going to be in awe of Tim Duncan. He's just going to go out there, realize it's his job to guard Tim Duncan, do as well as he can, realize that, you know, Tim Duncan can score 20 points on anybody, and, you know, he's not going to let it get to him mentally. So he's going to try hard. He's definitely going to hit the glass. You know, the Blazers scouts had some questions about whether he's, you know, better able to defend fours or fives. You know, their conclusion was kind of he was stuck in between, didn't necessarily have, you know, the quickness or maybe the speed to guard some of the more athletic fours, maybe didn't have the ideal size to guard some of the best fives in the league. So he's not a perfect fit, but he's solid. He's going to be better than anyone they can get from the D League. So I think the end conclusion will be as soon as his health allows, he'll be stepping in and filling, you know, as many minutes as he probably can. I think he can probably get away with playing Pendergraph, you know, up to 20 to maybe 25 at the absolute max minutes a game before he starts to become a huge liability. So I think that's, you know, not the best solution, but it's kind of a Band-Aid. So what we're getting at here is a long list of Blazers injuries. You know, the list is too long to even repeat. Everybody's read it. But, you know, seven or eight Blazers have gone down for extended periods this season. And, you know, the maymays that are kind of floating right now, is it bad luck? Are they cursed? You know, is it something in the water? Is this the curse of Bill Walton or Sam Bowie? I mean, I tend to not really listen to all that stuff, but I also, you know, try to look for patterns and try to, you know, look at past indicators, you know, the predictors of future performance. And I think if you're the Blazers right now, you've got some serious soul searching to do in terms of what just happened over the last 9 months. Would you agree? I mean, do the Blazers have to ask themselves those questions? Can they just write this off as bad luck?
Well, I think you always have to ask those questions, but you know, I don't see a real pattern here. I mean, an injury like Prisbilla suffered to the patellar tendon, you know, we're talking about this. Nordstrom, when he did his research, found five guys this decade who it's happened to. That's out of like 300 team seasons. So your odds of having that happen to you in any given season are something about 1 in 50. And something like a tendon or a broken bone, which is what the Blazers have suffered a lot from, is not something really that the training staff can do anything about other than telling guys to drink more milk, maybe, to build up their bones. You know, these are fluke, catastrophic injuries. What usually tends to be more connected to the performance of the training staff, I'd say, is situations where you have nagging injuries or injuries that are recurring. That's what, I mean, I think the one place that you could start to raise potentially some questions is, you know, Greg Oden's patella. Was there an effect from last year when he had the chip fracture? You know, I think Wendell Maxey, our good friend at Beyond the Beat, was the first person to bring up that connection. You know, the medical staff was very clear after the surgery that there was no connection, but you can certainly see how those two might be related. You know, something like Rudy Fernandez's situation where it's a lingering thing, but, you know, probably potentially something that predated even his time with the Blazers. So, you know, I don't necessarily see that.
Okay, so I talked to a medical expert who I'm going to leave anonymous for now because I'm going to run a whole feature with him at some point here. But here was his take on things. He said, you know, you've got, you know, this is a corporation, right? The Portland Trail Blazers are a multi-million dollar company. So if any other aspect of the company was performing like or was producing the results that the injuries, as bad as the injuries have been over the last 9 months, what you would see is sort of not an overhaul necessarily. No one's saying that, but what you would see would be a thorough examination sort of from top to bottom about why we're getting there. So, I mean, if the accounting department was leaking $15 million for unexplained reasons, they would take a look at it. You know, if the sponsorship group was losing sponsors at, you know, a rate that the Blazers are losing players, they would obviously take a very thorough look at it from top to bottom. And what this medical expert suggested to me was that, you know, if in the best interest for Paul Allen's, the best interest of his business would be to hire an outside consultant to take a look at every aspect related to the Blazers' injuries and to how they've acquired players that have been injured. So he's saying don't point the fingers at any of the training staff, you know, and really don't point the fingers at all, but just take a look and gather some information. So the first step would be to look at all the medical procedures that they put the players through, or all the testing they put the players through before the draft. Are those the same tests that are done by everyone else around the league? How much information can you gather about that? Are you doing everything, you know, crossing your T's and dotting your I's, everything to do with evaluating the players, that first evaluation? Is there more you can do prior to even that evaluation in terms of looking at people's medical backgrounds? Are you doing absolutely everything? Now, publicly stated by KP in the past, they would say that they've done everything. They fully do their homework. You know, some of these things are fluke. You know, all the injuries are kind of different injuries, like you mentioned. Some are wear and tear. Some are just extremely random knee injuries that, you know, rarely occur. But when you've got so many in a short period of time, he's saying any other aspect of the business, you would go right to it and ensure, you know, basically eliminate any other factor besides bad luck is what he would suggest you do. So you start from that medical evaluation process and you go through to the training regimen. So what are these people doing on a daily basis? How does that compare to your competitors? How much information can you gather about other training staffs and what they're doing with their players on a regular basis? How are minor injuries that could potentially develop into major injuries being handled on a daily basis? Is that comparable to your competitors? And he said there's so many variables throughout all of these processes that, you know, if a few things are off, you know, who knows what it could potentially lead to. And that's kind of how some injuries, especially the wear and tear ones, could get worse. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a problem with anyone individually in the training staff, but it could just be the standards and practices of how, you know, the team has been doing it. And there's constant updates to, you know, how you treat injuries. And what his main argument was that the medical community is so good at treating injuries now. I mean, guys can have catastrophic knee injuries like Greg Oden and be back playing within, say, 6 months, that sometimes, you know, that produces a false confidence in the minds of players, but also the minds of training staffs in terms of, you know, maybe they're overlooking some minor things, maybe they're not, who knows. But that could put players in at a higher risk situation for injury, if that makes sense. So what he would say is you need to get a fresh set of eyes, a knowledgeable, you know, consultant type expert to review everything about all the players involved in the injuries, but also the processes that the team has in place prior to getting the players, dealing with the players, and then also the recovery process as well. So he wants to make sure that, you know, once players are injured, all best practices are being followed for getting those players back to health as soon as possible. And, you know, he would say that this medical expert advised this needs to come from someone who doesn't have a dog in the fight. In other words, someone who's an outside consultant coming in to review all of these procedures. To me, all of that makes a lot of sense. And given how much money is on the line, given how much money Greg Oden's injury costs you, I mean, it's got to be, this most recent injury, I would say, it's costed them millions of dollars, if not tens of millions of dollars, in terms of the general interest in the team, jersey sales, you know, potential future partnerships, sponsorships, et cetera. I mean, you're looking at huge bills, not to mention the medical procedures, everything. I mean, this is just all these injuries are costing Paul Allen so much money that he needs to really look at this from a business perspective and, you know, get some fresh eyes on it. So that's what this guy had to say. Any thoughts on that?
I mean, I don't think that there's any time probably that sort of review is a bad idea, but, you know, I would be more likely to be concerned if this was a pattern over a couple of different years. And, I mean, obviously there's been injuries, obviously a lot with Oden in particular, but it's not like anyone questioned the Blazers training staff last year, I don't think, you know, or you talked about the severity of the team's injuries last year. It's just that they all happened to have come together in this short period. And to me, you know, that when you have that sample size that small, it indicates that something is going to be a fluke. You know, not necessarily luck, but not really indicative of the, you know, true situation.
Well, you know, and I think that would most likely, if, you know, they do this full review of everything, that's probably going to be one of the largest, most likely conclusions to be drawn from this. But But wouldn't you rather make sure you knew that that was the case rather than just assuming that was the case? I mean, as a Blazers fan, wouldn't you feel a lot more confident if the team hired outside consultant or whatever it would be, come through, reevaluate all the processes and say, hey, these processes are sound. Everything was handled. We made a few recommendations, but in the end, this was fluke. I mean, can't we get to a more solid ground than just saying, hey, these are probably fluke? And don't you think the Blazers, it would be in their best interest to do that? I mean, one thing that did come out was that Greg Oden's agent said he was going to, you know, put Greg through a whole new set of medical, you know, examinations to ensure, you know, basically to try to investigate what caused his injuries to ensure that they may not happen again and kind of to better protect him in the future from potential injury. And I thought that was a great step by them, and they absolutely should be doing that because Greg, you know, potentially costed himself tens of million dollars in future salaries with this last injury, this most recent injury. So I think it's absolutely in his best interest to do it. And it's like if a guy like Greg can figure that out and the light bulb goes off in his head that he needs to be protecting himself, then I think the light bulb should be going off in Blazers management and also Blazers ownership and saying, hey, we need to make sure exactly what we're doing. We need to investigate it. We need to know the facts, and we can make decisions from there. And I don't think that necessarily that's stepping on anybody's toes, you know? It's just if you have this kind of performance and you're in a company this large with this many millions of dollars on the line, there should be a review. I mean, how could there not be, you know?
I mean, I think maybe, you know, something like this should probably, if you're going to do a review, sometimes it's as good to do it in prosperous times as it is to do it in times of trouble. You know, just it's easier done then. And I think that no matter how you frame that message, it is going to come off as critical of the training staff.
Well, I mean, they can take it how they want to take it, you know. But the training staff, at some point, they're not responsible for the. I don't personally hold the training staff responsible for these injuries, really, in any direct way. Without, because you know, we don't have access to the information on a day-to-day basis about how they're training the players. But how can the training staff not expect to be looked at, given this track record? I mean, if your boss came down and said, hey, you know, we've had 7 players go down. You know, 8 players go down in the last 6 months. We want to take a look at everything. We would like your cooperation. Wouldn't you feel like, especially if you knew you had done everything right, wouldn't you gladly participate in that investigation so that you didn't have to deal with those kinds of things? It's in the best interest of the team going forward. I would expect they would want to participate, and they would gladly participate because it would make their lives easier.
And if you would think if the team was able to come out and say something like that, you know, to the public, it would restore their confidence in any questions. But I've never heard of anything like it in the NBA, certainly.
Well, have you ever heard of 8 players going down in one season?
Well, the Golden State Warriors have.
Well, yeah, but they're not a real NBA team. This is a real NBA team we're talking about with real NBA players. All right. We needed some levity at the end of this discussion. Hey, look, I'm not trying to point any fingers, cast any doubts upon the Blazers medical staff. From everything they say, they've got the best strength trainers, you know, some of the best trainers. They have an incredible doctor who operated on Greg Oden, you know, within less than 24 hours after he was injured. I can't even imagine if the guy slept after, you know, dealing with Greg. I mean, I don't think at face value there's no real red flags by any part of the situation. But I don't think face value is good enough here. That's my only point. I think it's time to take a fresh look. And any other business would do this, you know? I mean, if we were in any other business besides professional sports and we were not talking about the medical aspects of the players, a review would be in order, you know? I mean, what happens if all the Storm jerseys just disappeared out of your office mysteriously, you know, and you're selling them to some hoodlum on the street at 40% off retail and you're making millions of dollars and costing your organization millions of dollars? You don't think they're going to come and ask you questions?
I think they would come and ask me some questions, and I don't know that I would have any answers for them.
All right. Well, after all that really dark and disgusting talk about the Blazers, I think we can talk about one man who is clearly shining in the light. That man is Sam Presti, the chief executive, or is he the general manager? Is that his title, or does he get a cool title?
He is the general manager, and I believe he also has a vice president title or something. I'm not sure on the other title.
That would be Sam Presti of the quote-unquote Oklahoma City Thunder, who just absolutely, completely owned the Utah Jazz in a trade yesterday. Might have been my favorite moment of this NBA year. I can't tell you how excited I am about it once I finally realized what he had pulled off, and it took a little while. But why don't you set the scene for this trade? What happened, and how did it come to pass?
Well, you know, I want to point out that even though I think that the Thunder basically stole Eric Maynard yesterday, it doesn't mean I think it was a bad trade for the Utah Jazz. It was just a case of both teams being in their respective situations, and the Thunder was in a position where they had a chance to make things easier for the Utah Jazz and put that to very good use yesterday. So the Thunder sends the draft rights to Peter Faja, a German they drafted in 2002 while still in Seattle. And I still remember that draft night when I thought the Sonics had actually drafted Darius Singhila and was thrilled with that, and then found out they had drafted some teenager from Germany. So little did I know that 7 years later he would be involved in a trade like this. And in exchange, they get Matt Harpreen, who has retired unofficially but not formally announced his retirement because his contract is covered by insurance in even the last year of his deal. And then Eric Maynard, Utah's first-round pick out of, why am I now blanking on his college, Virginia Commonwealth, I should say. And, you know, so basically what the Thunder is doing is taking on Harpreen's contract, which would put the Jazz deep into the luxury tax. You know, they were paying dollar for dollar on each of those that $6.5 million that he's owed this year. And then also they take on a little bit of his deal that's not covered by insurance the rest of the way. It's between $1.7 and $1.8 million. And that's basically the cost to the Thunder. They basically bought Eric Maynard for that amount, while on the other hand, the Jazz saved at least about $8 million and potentially a little bit more, depending on how they play things with filling the 13th spot on the roster that they're required to have. So it's a huge, huge savings for the Jazz. You can't really look askew at that. You know, that's a big thing for them, especially, you know, a small market franchise in a tough economy. But for the Thunder, it's just a bargain to get a prospect like Maynard for that. You know, second-round picks were going for $2 million last year when I think the Rockets bought in to get Chase Budinger, for example. So you're getting a guy who was the 20th pick of the draft for that kind of price, and you've got his rookie contract for the next 3 years to be the backup to Russell Westbrook. So a very nice addition for the Thunder.
Yeah, so here's the thing with the Utah Jazz. I mean, how can we say this is a great trade for them when they're the ones who put themselves into this luxury tax hell to begin with? I mean, wasn't this just the final byproduct of some pretty poor cap management over the last, you know, 5 years dating back to the Kirilenko signing?
Well, it was a situation where it all sort of came together. I mean, after this year, they're not going to be in as bad of a situation with the tax, depending, no matter what they do with Carlos Boozer, but especially with Harpreen's contract coming off the books. You know, it was just a position where they were sort of forced to bite the bullet for 1 year because they didn't want to lose Paul Millsap for nothing after the Blazers extended a qualifying offer to them. And you could sort of say that with that decision, or excuse me, an offer sheet, and by not letting Millsap play this year for the qualifying offer in Utah, that the Kevin Pritchard was sort of responsible for this whole thing.
I know, it's great, isn't it? I love how, well, I'm not sure if we should say Kevin Pritchard was responsible for the whole thing. Tom Penn, I think, with Kevin Pritchard sort of looking over his shoulder as he fills out the test, maybe. So let's look at what it means for Oklahoma City. So Utah obviously saves a bunch of money, sets themselves up potentially for another trade to clear even more money, as Hollinger wrote about today. But for Oklahoma City, I mean, this was a huge coup. So not only do they get, you know, kind of an ideal backup point guard, which is, you know, serviceable, young, good potential, small contract. He's obviously on the rookie scale. So everything that they would want in a backup point guard, you know, behind Russell Westbrook, they got. So, you know, huge need met. But then they also have this Harpreen contract, which, as you mentioned, is covered by insurance. And isn't that pretty much one of the most desirable assets that's available on the trade market coming up to the deadline here in a couple months? I mean, is there anything besides, you know, an insurance-covered deal at that size, what was it, $6.5 million? That's going to be expiring at the end of this year, that a rebuilding team would want more than that? I mean, it seems to me like that would be the single best chip out there.
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty good one. The one thing that the Thunder has done with this trade that Hollinger pointed out was that any team that's over the tax and trying to get under it is basically, you know, that took away their option of going to the Thunder and using their cap space for that. But if there's a team that's simply trying to become bigger players in 2010, this summer's free agency market, and wants to clear off bad contract off their books, Caron Butler being an example of somebody who might be in that situation. I don't know that he's a good fit for the Thunder whatsoever, but he's not. But someone like that could potentially be a guy who becomes available to the Thunder, you know. And then if you're a franchise that's struggling financially, like so many of them in the league are, you know, right now, then the fact that not only do you get out of that contract beyond this summer, but you also get out of that contract essentially this year, because by the trade deadline, very little of Harper's contract would still be owed by the team. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of $300,000 is all they'd have to pay.
So this is very similar to what a team would have been able to do by trading for Rafe LaFrenz last year at the trade deadline, correct? I mean, it's just basically fully, close to fully insured expiring contract, which allows you to pass off all the costs of that player to the insurance company and then take that salary off your books at the end of the year. So what we saw last year was Pritchard saving those savings for himself and just cashing the insurance checks, letting Rafe's contract expire after there was so much talk that he would try to move that for, you know, a large piece. Now, Rafe's contract was obviously quite a bit bigger. It was, what, like $12 or $13 million. Harpering's is like $6 million. But if you combine Harpering with, say, Etan Thomas, like you mentioned, who has a roughly $7 million contract, you're in that same range. Is Presti, you know, which way are you leaning? Do you think Presti will sit on this and just take the savings for himself and be a huge player this coming summer when there's going to be a lot of guys available? Obviously he has a problem trying to get big names to go to Oklahoma City, although they do have a lot of attractive guys on the roster that would, you know, maybe make some people think twice, but it is Oklahoma City, which is going to be a stumbling block for, you know, the real marquee names. Or do you think he tries to pick somebody off here at the deadline? I mean, which way do you think he's leaning at this point? I mean, you and Sam are pretty tight. You guys, you know, hang out at holiday parties, have matching sweaters, that kind of a thing.
I thought that was me and you. I don't know that I have a good sense for it. It's going to depend on how things play out the next couple of months before the deadline, who decides to become a seller, what kind of players are on the market. But my suspicion right now would be that probably there's not going to be anybody that's going to come available that's going to be quite at the quality of the players that are in this free agent class. And obviously I don't think Oklahoma City is going to really be a player for the Wades and the Jameses and the Bosches, that level of free agents. But there's a nice second tier there as well. And if you could pick up a center to help solidify that position, you know, their future is very bright. So I don't know that there's a guy like that who would become available in trade. Tyson Chandler, they've already passed on, would be the one guy who's in a situation kind of like that. But Charlotte has also kind of ignored the 2010 free agency, so maybe not.
Well, in any case, you got to love this move from Oklahoma City. This is one of these, like, subtle chess moves where you're just getting this backup point guard for nothing. You've got this insurance contract, which is another chip. I mean, talk about the goal of flexibility, which, you know, this whole wave of GMs always talks about, you know, having the most possible moves facing them. That's kind of what position Presti's found himself in. That was kind of fun to watch, and it kind of thinks through yesterday as like, holy cow, he just stole Maynard. Holy cow, he has this great trade chip. Good stuff. Gotta love it. All right, let's close this podcast with a prediction, KP. Are the Blazers going to make the playoffs?
If you ask me standing here today, probably not.
Oh, really?
I would put the odds at like 35% to 40%. I mean, just they've struggled so much with Juwan Howard at center, and the absences of Prisbilla and Oden are going to be so costly. And the West is tough this year. I mean, you've got even Memphis is playing pretty well and putting themselves in the playoff picture. You know, Oklahoma City would be on the outside looking in if the season ended today, but I think that they're going to finish above 500, especially, you know, if Eric Maynard can help them out and maybe they add another piece in a trade like this down the road. You know, I see them potentially moving ahead of the Blazers in the Western Conference picture right now.
You typical bandwagon fan, KP. You're loving the team for 3 months, and now you're right back off, and you think they're going to the lottery. Oh, that's so heartbreaking for me to listen to. Well, I'll take the other side on this. I do think they're going to make the playoffs. I think that if you've got Brandon Roy and LaMarcus Aldridge, okay, this is assuming Roy's healthy and his shoulder ding is nothing serious, but I think those two guys are capable of being better than the Thunder by themselves. So as long as you've got those two guys, maybe Rudy comes back, I think they're going to be slightly better than 500, and Roy's pretty crunch, clutch when it comes to the stretch of the season, carrying his team into the playoffs, closing strong. Maybe some guys come back. I like the Blazers' chances. Do anything else this week?
Just a happy holidays to all our readers, our listeners out there.
Really? Do you really mean that? People say that. Are you serious, though?
Of course, I want a very happy holidays for everyone.
What does the Pelton dude family do to celebrate the holidays? Anything special?
Well, we get together at my grandparents' house, and we eat traditional ravioli for Christmas Day dinner. That's the Italian side of the family.
Hey, I have a question for you. Is it an Italian tradition to open presents on Christmas Eve?
No, that sounds right. We don't do it, but that sounds right.
Because this Italian exchange student who's staying with my parents, I'm going over their place for Christmas. He's got them completely convinced that all the presents need to be opened on Christmas Eve. And I can't tell if he's just doing that because he wants to open his presents early or if that's actually the tradition in Italy. But in any case, he's convinced them completely that this is how it's going to go down. So I guess tomorrow I'm actually celebrating Christmas thanks to this quote unquote Italian tradition. So we're not eating ravioli. We're eating a giant piece of meat, in my dad's words, which I. Honestly, I don't even want to know what that means, but we'll see what happens.
We'll also have ham. It's not completely untraditional, but yeah, the ravioli is kind of it's the highlight of the year. It's my single favorite meal on this planet.
Ravioli is your single favorite meal on this planet. I'll have to bookmark that one.
It's prepared by my grandparents, yes.
Excellent. All right. Well, enjoy your holidays. Don't eat too much ravioli. And we'll catch you next week for a post-Christmas edition of the Blazers Meltdown podcast.
Have a good one.
Fuck being up north, delirious, more serious. So killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup. For you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment, sports, drugs, entertainment, to the arraignment.